effort to ensure sufficient supplies.
It's getting ridiculous when you're paying like $150 a month and you're used to this amount, and then it gets raised to $300. It becomes a problem.
With the pandemic, like you said, it's really difficult because people are struggling economically. They're getting fired from their jobs. Some of them are struggling to find new jobs, and this is coming even more.
Governments in 22 of the 27 EU member states have taken temporary steps to try and support businesses and households. But so-called energy poverty continues to rise.
Many ministers mentioned how the situation beyond the EU eastern borders creates uncertainty on the markets and how the gas flows from Russia have dropped significantly in recent months.
But the European Commission acknowledges Russia has honoured all of its gas supply contracts. Moscow insists it's willing to supply more if new contracts are signed. This has already happened with Germany and Turkey, the Kremlin says. As was stated recently in the European Parliament, perhaps the best way to ensure energy security would be for the EU to stop using Ukraine to provoke Russia. This, as Ukraine is corrupt to the core and at the highest levels, according to the European Court of Auditors, which is the EU's financial watchdog. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There's no end in sight to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload. Donations made to this charity in West London on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in three decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, And you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will be most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages. The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty, almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty, and it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Sai Purza, London.
Protesters outside the Israeli embassy have called for a boycott of Israel and those who support it, the delegitimization of the Zionist regime by Britain, which gave birth to it, and an end to apartheid.
We see you! We know your complicity! And we won't let you enable the ruthless and barbaric actions of the Israeli state in our name!
Israel is finding it more and more difficult to prevent the global community from knowing what's going on in the occupied territories. No amount of algorithms can stifle the cry for justice, and more people are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians.
For decades, Israel has been chipping away at Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now it's set its sights on Sheikh Jarrah. In May 2021, this neighborhood became an international focal point, with residents resisting expulsion using digital activism. The diaspora was galvanized, 180,000 people took to London streets, and the land grab was postponed as a result. Londoners say the videoing of atrocities is working, but the Israeli lobby is strong.
Mona Al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, as she was transmitting the demolition of the garden center of the Salha family, her Instagram was blocked. So as far as we can, the Palestinians and supporters try and portray to the world what is happening there. What we need to do is to find ways of turning that into a change in government policy.
The message is getting out. I'm of an age where I went first to Israel in the 60s, shortly after the Seven-Day War. People in this country did not know about Palestine. There was no understanding of the Nakba. There was no understanding of the expulsion of Palestinians. And for years and years, the Israeli government was allowed to continue, and this ignorance was perpetuated by the media.
Racism is a hot topic in the Western world, with people rising up against all forms of discrimination and inequality. And for many, Israel is synonymous with racism.
I think there are still organizations like the BBC which do not report what is going on the ground. Therefore, tools like social media are really, really important.
They're not going to get away with it. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history may be long, but it bends towards justice. We will win this fight, because justice will win.
Demolitions have begun, some in the dead of night. Stun grenades were used, the power cut, and dozens arrested. The ethnic cleansing continues, as does the fight to end the last apartheid on Earth. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia's guided missile cruiser Varyag and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tributes, paraded along Iranian and Chinese warships in Iran's southern territorial waters as the last phase of a joint naval maneuver codenamed Maritime Security Belt. Conducted over 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean, the one-day drill engaged some of the latest naval equipment of the three participating countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, together with the navies of the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China, staged a joint drill with the motto of Together for Peace and Security. the ultimate goal of the exercises is to enhance the readiness of the three countries in confronting marine threats that are posed to civilian seafaring.
China's Urumqi destroyer and Iran's domestically built Dena and Jamaran destroyers were among the vessels that were deployed to the drills. The trilateral maneuvers saw the three navies practicing anti-piracy operations, where they freed two commercial ships from pirates. Iran's Navy says the drill will significantly boost the three countries' coordination and synergy in combating piracy and ensuring the safety of international shipping in the strategic Indo-Pacific region.
North of the Indian Ocean is of a special significance in terms of global trade. That's why it is associated with constant threats such as terrorism and piracy. Therefore, closer cooperation between the actors in this region promises safer maritime trade for all countries.
North of the Indian Ocean hosts more than half of the world's maritime oil trade, which passed through three strategic straits of Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb, and Malacca, together forming what's known as the Golden Triangle of international trade. It's the third time Iran, China, and Russia are holding a joint drill in this body of water, with the aim to turn the thruway into a safe transit route for all passing ships. Iran, Russia, and China wrapped up their joint military exercises with strong messages. On top of them is their growing naval cooperation to ensure a collective security in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. This as they advised Western actors in the region to avoid destabilizing activities. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Iran warns that Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed the regime has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify atrocities against Palestinians. The ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said that genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. The ministry further stressed Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered crimes committed during the Second World War.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Beg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative. And yet, I have not been convicted of any crime. I've never had my day in court. And I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Beg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Beg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
the limelight.
Measured by the value of the wages that workers take home, which this board regards as the most important metric for assessing the health of America's economy, President Biden's first year in office was not a very good year. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. It has been written by the paper's editorial board. The piece is titled, President Biden's Economy is Failing the Big Mac Test. Measured by the value of the wages that workers take home, which this board regards as the most important metric for assessing the health of America's economy, President Biden's first year in office was not a very good year. The dollar figures on workers' paychecks rose handsomely over the past 12 months. But for most workers, that wasn't enough to keep pace with the highest inflation in several decades, which eroded the value of each of those dollars. The purchasing power of the average worker's weekly pay declined by 2.3% from December of 2020 to December of 2021. Data for the final 20 days of Joe Biden's first year in office is not available as yet, but is unlikely to improve that picture. Joe Biden inherited an economic crisis precipitated by the coronavirus pandemic, and his administration deserves credit for orchestrating a fiscal response on a scale commensurate with the nation's need. The outstanding achievement of Mr. Biden's first year in office was the passage of an economic aid package in March that shielded Americans from the economic effects of the pandemic and helped to deliver a faster recovery than in other developed nations. In simple terms, things could have been a lot worse. The Biden administration also has taken some significant steps to improve the nation's longer-term economic prospects, notably by pushing an infrastructure bill through Congress and by launching a revival of antitrust enforcement. In a late December tweet, Joe Biden quoted with evident approval an assessment that he had compiled the strongest first-year economic track record of any president in the last 50 years. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on Friday, 21st of January, "By most traditional metrics, the pace of our current recovery has exceeded even the most optimistic expectations." But most Americans don't share the administration's sunny view of its economic record, and it is little mystery why. The average worker's paycheck doesn't buy as many hamburgers as it did last year. Using hamburgers to measure inflation is a twist on The Economist magazine's Big Mac Index, which tracks the price of the classic hamburger in different currencies. The government's Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7% in 2021, the biggest jump since 1982. Joe Biden's approval rating remains low, and poll after poll finds that Americans are not pleased with his handling of the economy. Nearly two-thirds of the American public says the administration is insufficiently focused on inflation, according to a recent CBS News opinion poll. There are similar numbers in other recent polls. The nation's mood has soured, even as the economy has added more than 6 million jobs over the last year. For the core of the labor force, workers aged 25 to 54, employment recovered more quickly than in the prior three recessions, dating back to the 1990s. That's a big deal. Even when paychecks are losing value, it's better to get one. Low-wage workers have seen particularly strong wage growth. For workers in the bottom third of the wage distribution, Arin Rajit Dube, An economist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst estimates that average wage gains have exceeded inflation. If inflation remains strong, however, the number of workers in that fortunate category is likely to shrink. And even for those workers, the pace of wage growth adjusted for inflation is weaker than it was in the 2 years before the pandemic. Economic output, or gross domestic product, GDP, has climbed above its pre-crisis level. Investors have reason to be happy too. The Standard & Poor's 500, a broad measure of the stock market, rose by 19.3% during Joe Biden's first year as president. The market's large losses this past week wiped out only a small portion of those gains. The White House finds itself in the position of a physician who has administered a successful course of treatment, but who has neglected to prepare the patient for the side effects or to give the timeline for a full recovery. A lot of pain was averted, but it's hard to feel gratitude for things that didn't happen. The economic outlook is strong, but it's hard to feel gratitude for things that haven't happened yet. Right now, the pain of inflation is front and center for most Americans. No one is surprised when recessions deliver unpredictable disruptions. We're now being reminded that recoveries are messy. People are trying to buy more cars than are readily available. Diners are more eager than waiters to return to restaurants. The nation's cargo ports have been overwhelmed by a surge of imports. Biden, however, has contributed to his own political woes. Through much of the fall, the president and other administration officials seem to be downplaying the dangers of inflation. Mr. Biden also continues to present the administration's longer-term economic initiatives, like antitrust enforcement and a push for childcare subsidies, as measures that would help to combat inflation. The effect of such policies would not be felt for some time, and Mr. Biden's insistence on this implausible narrative may be contributing to a sense that he's not taking inflation seriously. The administration has not taken action in some areas that could help to restrain inflation or mitigate its effects. The tariffs that Donald Trump imposed on Chinese imports remain in place. Legal immigration has continued to decline, worsening labor shortages. A one-year expansion of the child tax credit helped to reduce the share of American children living in poverty to the lowest level since the government began to keep records in the 1960s. But Democrats, unable to agree on the terms of a permanent expansion, have allowed the expanded benefits to expire, depriving millions of working families of much-needed help. Some of the president's critics assert that the United States missed the chance for a Goldilocks recovery, neither too cold nor too hot. They argue that a smaller dose of economic aid would have delivered growth without higher inflation. But European nations with generally administered proportionally smaller doses of aid are now experiencing both less inflation and slower recoveries. Critics also ought to keep in mind that not so distant past, in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, the United States similarly delivered an inadequate dose of aid. Inflation remained quiescent, but that was little comfort to the millions who waited years to find work. The challenge now is to bring inflation back under control without undermining the economic recovery. The work will mostly be done by the U.S. Federal Reserve, not by Joe Biden or his administration. The role of presidents in shaping the nation's economic fortunes is generally overstated, but if the government can complete the work it has begun, the administration may yet deserve the victory lap that it is taking for successful stewardship of the nation's economy. The discomforting truth is that the United States last year faced a choice between a protracted period of economic pain and an economic recovery whose benefits are temporarily attenuated by high inflation. Joe Biden made the right choice, but it came at a real price. Economically, for the nation, and politically, for him.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wei. The U.S. confrontation with Russia continues unabated, and it appears not all European countries are in sync or in step with U.S. moves when it comes to the nuclear power nation. Germany has said that it will not supply Kiev with weapons for now, something which has drawn the anger from Ukraine. Is it because of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will examine why Germany has taken a different approach than the warmonger U.S., and if this split is true among other European nations. We will also take a look at whether the U.S.'s ultimate goal is to destabilize Central Asian countries in order to prevent, as they see it, Russia's expansionist aspirations. All right, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Vladimir Goldstein. He's an associate professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, who joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Also joining us, Urs Unkopf, Government Relations Director at BWA, who joins us from Berlin.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you, gentlemen, and I'm going to start with you, Urs Unkopf, if I may. When it comes to Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. position? It seems like it's pretty clear that it wants to provide arms to not only the Baltic states, if I'm correct to say that, and it also has NATO doing its military maneuvers, moving eastward, and putting pressure on Russia. I mean, at this point, we're looking at the latest that we have of U.S. arms delivery, 90 tons of U.S. military aid, part of the $200 million, from what I'm reading here, of lethal aid, which is part of the $2.5 billion delivered so far. I can get into some of the details behind this. What are we looking at when it comes to this massive military injection when it comes, and it's emanating from the U.S. mainly here?
Good evening. Thank you for the question. So I think it is quite clear that the Biden administration and President Biden don't want to risk an immediate open war. This is why those discussions on arms delivery and all those preparatory measures are now pushed forward in the U.S. It is quite clear that Ukraine is not a NATO member, and in the Baltic states there are totally different conditions, different frameworks applying. Let me also add from the German point of view, the recent days there has been widely discussed in the German media the statement of the now former head of the German Navy, which was definitely not helpful for the debate. I think at the moment and at this phase of the conflict where we have now arrived, it is the most important task of every politician to de-escalate in every way. That means de-escalation on the military as well as in the political level, and also important on the level of public discourse. The German Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock, has clearly stated during her recent visit to Moscow and during the meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, that Germany is not going to deliver arms into conflict zones, and that has also been confirmed towards the Ukrainian Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba. So it is quite clear that Germany will try to use its position to negotiate and to get all the relevant stakeholders, involved parties, back to the negotiation table, because this is the most important in this situation to prevent an open war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you have that take on this, and I'm going to ask you, Vladimir Goldstein. Our guest there from Berlin says that it doesn't seem like there's going to be a war scenario that's going to pan out of this. I'm looking at deliveries of U.S.-made Stinger shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles to Kiev. I'm looking at the U.K. Let me go down the list, who has delivered a small number of anti-armor defensive weapon systems. I mean, if it smells like war, it looks like war, it looks like there's going to be a war. What do you think? Do you think that this is the scenario set for war or not?
Well, I think it's we all know in the real world things can happen. And potentially, of course, it can lead to the war. But I don't think there is interest in terms of the war, neither on the Russian side, nor on the Ukrainian side, nor on the European side. Of course, you know, it's in the interest of the United States and probably, England is somehow to create this appearance of danger, appearance of trouble, but they are definitely pursuing their own interests. There is interest of American military-industrial complex. You know, they're very active. They like to sell their weapons. There are interests of some industry sector. They are not very much interested in Russia trading with, Germany. They prefer Germany and other European countries dealing, with the United States, gas companies and oil companies. So they pursue their own interests. But, you know, there are endless amount of reports, including BBC and many other people, that people neither in Russia nor in Kiev feel imminent war. They know that this is just, saber rattling, talk, people pursuing their own political agendas. And, this is a very good example of German Navy chief Schönbach, who said that this is all kind of, the war is not happening, and the idea with Crimea is over, let's move forward, let's have pragmatic discussion. However, he was immediately forced to retire. So in other words, the United States pushes this program, pursuing its military and economic interests, which lie not from the war, they benefit not from the war, but from fear-mongering, and warmongering and getting the stuff and splitting Germany from Russia. That's another very important dimension.
Aha. So you saved the best for last. I appreciate that. Urs Unkopf, are we looking at that? Are we looking at the fact that you have, and you're in Berlin, that Germany is standing up, and as you said, they want to see if this can be worked out. They're taking the diplomatic approach. This is said to be a first major test for the Social Democrat Scholz. Also, that German politicians understand Russia, so to speak, and that understanding remains alive, which is why there's a push for this to be taken down a notch or two, or even more. But is it true what our guest there said? Is there also a push somehow for Germany to be separated from Russia? Because Germany obviously is a major player in this whole scheme when it comes to European countries.
That's a very interesting question, and I would agree with many of the points my colleague mentioned so far. Of course, there are interest groups which try to push Germany back from Russia into a one-sided position towards Ukraine. But first and overall, Germany needs to align its foreign policy with its national interests. And our national interest do neither 100% comply with the Russian position nor 100% with the Ukrainian position. So that is also why the German business community and so far also the politics during the era of Angela Merkel has, for example, separated business relations from political relations. And it is also in our interest to develop good relations with Ukraine, but also on the same time to maintain those relations with Russia. Russia is one of the most important suppliers for oil and gas for Germany. Russia has fulfilled all its commitments in this sphere. And there have been various statements from different stakeholders that if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is technically ready to operate, also will be put into operation, it will not be a shutdown of a gas transit, natural gas transit through Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So all those questions needs to be discussed on a rational level. And once again, I would like to underline, we need to de-escalate and to put out the tension of this debate at the moment.
Sure. Well, you had one courageous Navy chief from Germany, Vladimir Goldstein, to stand up. He said it was nonsense to think that Russia was about to invade Ukraine, and that also praising, in a sense, the Russian President Vladimir Putin, said that he deserves respect. And then he went on to resign. This, the fact that he says it's nonsense goes flat against what the U.S. stance is. And, of course, the U.S. has pulled other countries to believe that Russia is going to invade. Is it nonsense, Russian invasion theory?
Yeah, I think it is nonsense. You know, the problem is that professionals, be it, you know, real academics, real military people, you know, Navy, German Navy have the intelligence sources. They know that very well. They can sense the mood in Ukraine, in Russia. There is no mood for war. So he just says something which kind of makes sense and based on reality. However, what I would want to stress is the amount of propaganda which one sees in British TV, in American TV, is mind-staggering. I left Russia and the Soviet Union in the 70s, and even then it wasn't such unified voice condemning this, pronouncing this, making all this kind of unified. God forbid that there is dissent, you know, note. The same thing is just now orchestrated by United States propaganda. So somebody who makes sense out of the blue declared a pariah and told to resign. But sooner or later, you know, there is what is important, that Germany is an economic powerhouse. They have their interests. They have their traditions. You know, Russia and Germany, what, you know, of course, they were in the wars, but they were trading. They were partners. There's endless amount of cultural, political, philosophical exchanges. So these two countries are more or less have to trade with each other and have to function. And they are located very close to each other in Europe. So why not United States and England, which is also very far from the Central Europe, interfere and play their geopolitical games at the expense, I want to underline, at the expense, not Ukraine. Ukraine can find their way negotiating, de-escalating, like you know, my colleague said, and Ukraine can function too. But they should promote American interest in the heart of Europe, because for the time being, that's what Ukraine is doing.
Well, maybe it's a good time for us to try to summarize very briefly, if you can, Ursulkov, why it is that Russia has been demonized by the U.S., not only demonized, but also cited as a national security threat. We can go back to when they said that they meddled in the U.S. elections, but of course Ukraine was the tipping point. Why do you think that Russia is on the target of the U.S. or the radar of the U.S. to such extreme?
Well, of course, it's a geopolitical competition where we see at the moment mainly three players, the U.S., China, and Russia. And also interesting is the second part of the statement of this former German Navy chief. He mentioned that we should align stronger with Russia in order to contain China. And one, we have to understand that it is not in our interest as a power in the center of Europe, as one of Europe's strongest players, as Germany, to play Russia against China, nor is it not in our interest to play the U.S. against Russia. And I hope that Germany, in the course of this year, will reset multilateral dialogue formats. Germany currently holds the presidency of the G7, which also could make a step towards Russia, towards retaking the dialogue. But at the moment, I see that we need to put out the tension of the public discourse to avoid a situation like we had before the First World War. Before the First World War started, every media, every newspaper was talking, was writing about the war and the possibility of war. And if we just talk about war and not how to avoid the war, then the war in the end will come. And this needs to be prevented with all possible forces from all stakeholders.
Well, it also, there needs to be a reminder here, which many may seem to have forgotten because it's going back to such a long time ago, Vladimir Goldstein, and that is the fact that Ukraine has mainly not been fighting Russian armed forces in the Donbas region. People don't seem to really realize that. And you know, yes, you know, Russia may have trained or may have armed them, but they're not doing the fighting. Russia's military involvement might be more so, if anything, on the advisory part of this. Which led to the separation. I mean, isn't that something that needs to be highlighted so people who are involved in this, any of the players, realize, you know, this is not Russian direct involvement?
That's absolutely the case. You know, what we know from the very recent history is, you know, Eastern Ukraine, Donbas region, were rather sympathetic to Kyiv until 2014, when, you know, they were demonized, they were immediately called separatists, traitors, blah, blah, blah. And now recent polls conducted by Kyiv suggest that, you know, people in Donbass don't want to be part of Kyiv regime. So what we have a very serious civil tension. So people in Donbass are Russian speakers. They are Russian, you know, culturally, while Kyiv want to subjugate them, not give them autonomy, not allow them to be their own choice. They want to subjugate them. They bombard them. They kill civilians. So far, 14,000 people were killed on all sides, but a lot of civilians. So it plays very bad in Russia, you know, because Russians feel that this is their Russian brothers. Furthermore, quite, you know, during recent times, many of the people in this Donbas region got their Russian passport. So they're technically Russians too. This is, of course, this is a complicated geopolitical game the countries play. But, you know, you have to be aware that Russia have to protect these people on eastern Donbas. So what's important is for everyone to sit at the table and discuss. But what we see that Ukraine prefers to hide that too. They prefer to talk and blame Russians. They prefer to get American aid. They prefer to play British aid. They prefer to claim victims while, you know, they haven't solved even, you know, situation in their own territory. They didn't solve it yet. So, you know, why on earth this country, which cannot solve, you know, their own problems, dictate Germany, mm-hmm. you know, United States, Russia, Canada, what to do? It's a really big unanswered question.
There was an interesting statement that came from the U.S. President Ursulkov just days ago, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought of it, even though he retracted that statement, and he said that a small-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine might not lead NATO to respond with full force the way that he was describing it. And that really ticked off Ukraine, and it took many by surprise. Again, scrambled to take back that statement. But do you think that that is something that the U.S. Actually means, that it's okay if it even turns out to be that way, that a small-scale incursion by Russia is something that the U.S. or NATO would tolerate?
Well, I think this statement once again shows how tense the situation is, but realistically, I think that the U.S. would risk a war, which would be, in every case, a nuclear war with Russia about Ukraine. It's more about to underline how the frontiers are at the moment, and I think that it is quite obvious that Putin is a strategist and he knows quite well how far he can go. The same applies for the Biden administration. So there needs just to be defined where their faces, where both could agree on a certain format of negotiations. It might be the Minsk group, but we should also be open for new formats to find a constructive solution.
All right, let's look at this from a vantage point that's not just about war and the possibility of it. Vladimir Goldstein, we know what had happened in Ukraine. The U.S. pretty much came out and said it was involved in the color revolution. They like colors. There was a revolution there. I think it was called purple for that color. I forget. Maybe you can tell us. So based on that, what color was it?
Orange.
Orange, I'm sorry. Okay, so you have that execution by the U.S., which stirred up the country, and some are suggesting, some analysts, that that's what the U.S. is actually after, Central Europe and the European countries that maybe were in the sphere of Russia, to create some kind of instability, Kyrgyzstan being the latest example, and this would then be a bulwark against Russia to prevent Russia from wanting to expand in their eyes. Do you think that that is the case?
Yeah, that's the case. You know, what we have to remember that after collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia was a kind of very weak and very weak on the international space. So United States believed that they can sort of call all the shots. So they, you know, play their games with Europe. They expanded NATO. And, you know, it worked very well in their favor, and they want to continue this way. So obviously when Russia becomes more self-assertive, it's already kind of a threat. So they are, you know, using that. But also in terms of geopolitics, we do have to remember that Europe is Europe. And this is very, you know, if we have EU and Russia, and, you know, after all, China wants to trade there. If this is a very powerful bloc, trading together, working together economically, then United States is actually an odd man out. They can be somewhere trading with Latin America, but they'll be kicked out of Europe because they're not placed there. They're geographically, they're not located. So they don't want to accept it. They want to stay in Europe. So I think this, you know, this certain Eastern European countries like Poland, Baltics, and Ukraine are their foothold, and they will do everything to protect it, which, you know, works, A, they preserve American interests, and B, due to geographical location of Ukraine, is precisely the place, you know, Ukraine and Poland, they separate Russia and Germany from, you know, getting a very, consistent economic relationship, which has, you know, been all the time. If you look at the history, you just mentioned First World War. One of the ideas, you know, there were negotiations between Russia and Germany. They wanted to work together, but for England, it was absolute sort of taboo. So they did all they could to set up Russia against Germany, and I think that's a pretty successful strategy of Anglo, you know, sphere to somehow to keep these two countries very separate from each other because it's in their interest.
All right, so since we're drawing down with the time here, Urs Unkopf, you know, it should all come down to the economy, and I'm looking at the point of view of Germany, looking at the situation, and even other European countries, when they, if they're going to be pressured by the U.S., I'm sure the question comes about, so what will we gain by going against Russia? Is the U.S. pressuring these countries with economic incentives to go against Russia, even though Russia, as I'm sure you're well aware, not only is a very big supplier of a variety of goods for Germany, perhaps, but in the bigger picture for Europe and the European Union. So how can the U.S. pressure these countries to go against Russia?
We had such a situation already when some senators from the Republicans announced that they would sanction all companies directly or indirectly working on the Nord Stream 2 project. But The German economy in general has a strong commitment in Russia as well as in Ukraine, and also our association has a reliable partner in both countries. So the German economy needs to define its own interests, and that can only be that we can continue with stable and good businesses in this region. Russia is a very important traditional partner since the 1970s. Russia delivers a significant share of Germany's energy consumption. Mm-hmm. However, there has been a common European effort in Ukraine within the last years, especially in regional developments, and also those efforts should not be taken off. So I think in a mid to long term perspective, also economic relations could help to build new bridges when politics find fail to find a common ground of speech. The economy can build new bridges.
Well, that's a hope there. And to round this off, Vladimir Goldstein, when you have the U.S. as our guest there just mentioned, and I think this happened not too recently, but it was very recent, Republican lawmakers in the U.S. saying that threatening Germany with sanctions if they were to, you know, have companies work on the Nord Stream 2. In essence, they're saying, let your customers pay double, triple the price for gas, but no, you shouldn't work on the project. So how does the U.S. look when it exerts that type of pressure on Germany?
Well, U.S. doesn't look, you know, very good. And I think what we have to be aware that, you know, Merkel was a very experienced politician with, you know, very stable relationship with the United States. And she probably could, you know, could push things back, you know, when you know, crazy American senators trying to gain some popularity at home would pronounce some idiotic propositions like, you know, extra sanctions. She could push back. I think now United States want to try this new leadership of Germany and see how kind of, you know, how resistant they will be. But, you know, there's nothing wrong in United States trying. You know, that's their interest. They are more than happy to promote their own sort of companies. Sure. They are more than happy to let Ukraine still be, you know, in the center of gas transportation. So Ukraine, by the way, somebody calculated 18% of their economy depends on the money they get from this old pipeline. So they did. So that's where Americans will be pushing, and I think it's up to Europeans to resist it and, you know, convince Americans that we you know, everybody has their own interest. Not the world is not reduced to Washington and American interest.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Vladimir Goldstein, many thanks for your contribution. Associate Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University from Providence, Rhode Island. And Urs Unkoff, thank you. Government Relations Director at BWA from Berlin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in.